collective insights as a voyage through topics and technologies revolutionizing human well-being. Groundbreaking approaches for a better world and a better life await you. Welcome to Collective Insights.
To the very first episode of the Neurohacker Collective podcast. We wanted to start a podcast where we can have these video dialogues because we have such interesting and brilliant people in our network who have various expertise in areas of neuroscience, cognitive enhancement, psychological development, etc. So this is the first of these dialogues. My name is Daniel Schmachtenberger. I'm heading up research and development here, and this is my first time to be on this side of a podcast, so forgive my clumsiness with it. And we are very excited to have the first conversation be with Dr. Zachary Stein. Zach is a very good friend and really brilliant and innovative thinker. He is a philosopher of education with a background in meta theory, integral theory, developmental psychology, psychometrics. Did his work in education and psychometrics at Harvard with Howard Gardner and kind of that whole multiple lines of intelligence, advancing what we think of as intelligence world. Worked with Kirk Fisher on advanced developmental psychology and in integral philosophy on that, and has written books on the topic, which we might get into a bit. And our topic today is understanding what intelligence is, what IQ is, and EQ and other kind of metrics related to intelligence, where they're good, where they're not adequate, what we're actually talking about when we talk about intelligence, what's actually meaningful here, what are better ways of defining it and assessing it, and then how much of it is fixed, how much is changeable, and what do we know about how to actually advance and develop what is actually worth developing here. So this is a topic that I don't know anyone who knows more about the depth of the philosophy of than Zach. Zach, amongst other things, was a founder of a really fascinating organization called Lectica, or a co-founder there, which is a method for advanced psychometric development across lots of lines, looking at someone's development in different aspects of cognition, their development in ethics and their epistemology and their moral reasoning, and how do we assess those things? How does the assessment affect the nature of what we're assessing? All like that. So Zach, thank you for being here today with us.
I'm so excited, Daniel. There's like no conversation I'd rather be in. So this is wonderful.
So intelligence, let's just dive right in. I think there are probably no scores that people have identified with as being important metrics of their capacity than IQ, maybe. So I'm curious for you to just start with the education of us. How did the IQ development, how did that score come about? What does it actually measure? How does that relate to the total picture of what intelligence is? What are multiple lines of intelligence? And how should we think about intelligence? I think everyone has a kind of intuitive sense of something that relates to processing speed and memory and computational power that is kind of in distinction to artistic inclination or interpersonal inclination. So start us off, dive in. How should we think about intelligence? What are the problems with how we think about it?
Yeah. So it's interesting you start with the notion of score, because that's really one of the hearts of the issues here, is that we have connected intelligence, which is something that goes on in the mind, with a particular instrument, right, that's been used to detect intelligence, so-called, or supposedly detect intelligence for a very long time. And so I think one of the things we need to think about is the IQ test and disentangling that a little bit from our conceptions of intelligence, because we've reified it and simplified it, I think drastically oversimplified it. And there's many great histories of IQ testing. I really like Stephen Jay Gould's great work called The Mismeasure of Man. And you see from reading this book that the IQ test was not an instrument of science, but an instrument of bureaucracy, and had to do with the socio-political history of quantitative objectivity. Right? So this has to do with the use of numbers in the manipulation of people. And this is a very important aspect of modernity. And it was hugely liberating in things like public health and census taking and other areas where mathematics liberated us into this new realm of social engineering. But of course, every step forward is a there's a dialectic to these kinds of developments. And pardon me. So what you find with the IQ test is that in France, turn of the century, you know, late 1800s, Binet was tasked by the French government to create a test that could be used to basically keep certain types of kids out of schools and give them special attention. So Binet was someone who specialized in a whole bunch of psychological fields, but especially the rehabilitation of the learning disabled. So the IQ test was really just a very gross sorting mechanism created in France to find those kids who needed special attention. And Binet was very explicit, and Stephen Jay Gould gives this beautiful account of Binet's dismay and concern at the reification of IQ. He thought this was just an instrument just to use to sort kids in a useful way in the public interest. It's not in any way a theory about the nature of the mind or about the nature of intelligence. That whole idea that the IQ test measures this intelligent kind of general intelligence, which is then genetically transmitted, that whole idea came from the Americans who imported the IQ test at the beginning of the First World War and at the same time created the multiple choice test. And boom, we got kind of large scale industrial strength standardized testing. And that's a gift of the kind of World War I kind of scramble, the preamble to World War I scramble in America. And so what was first just an instrument used to sort children to give them special attention with no psychological theory accompanied, right? Get that. It was atheoretical, became an instrument that was standardized, that was used to sort adults and children, and that came loaded with theoretical baggage about a general intelligence and about its genetic heritability. And so there's a long legacy, which of course Gould lays out, of how this got tied into the eugenics movement. I'm not going to get into that because I think it's a distraction. The key that I want to point out here is that IQ, as we think about it, right, has saturated the culture, but it's not as theorized as it needs to be, right? It's a, I call it a mongrel concept, right? Which is to say it's a concept that kind of supervenes on the actual realities of the mind, right? It's touching some things. It's what Roy Bhaskar, the great meta theorist, the great philosopher, you know, the late great, he called it a demi-reality, which is to say a mini, it's like, it's getting at something real, but it's a small version of what's real. And this is the IQ. So I like to compare it to the GDP as a number, right? The gross domestic product, right? Massively complex national economy. But again, in the scramble of a war effort to synthesize and to organize, give it one number and put it on a linear trajectory and use it to rank countries unilaterally and make it a single most valuable thing. Easy thing to do with a number, but a clear oversimplification. Sure. And so likewise, you know, it's not that you're not getting at something, you're getting at something, right? But it's a demi-reality, it's a small reality. Right. And so the IQ test became this, and it truncated our thinking about the nature of intelligence, and it became hypertrophied. And a lot of people don't realize that the IQ test was then prettied up and complicated a little bit, taken by the Educational Testing Service and made into the SAT. And so there's this long kind of continuous history of the use of these forms of, quote, intelligence testing, not really for scientific research about intelligence, but for the organization of educational systems and large-scale bureaucracies like the Army, which was where the first large-scale standardized test was ever created, was for the Army Alpha 1 and Alpha 2, which were to sort the incoming millions into the American Army for the World War I. So that's kind of the brief history of where this instrument came from. And so I'm not a big fan of the instrument itself. Now, there's been improvements to it. We have these newfangled ones, the Raven matrices, and some problems have been solved with objectivity and reliability, which were the first big concerns. So I'm going to kind of skip that side piece. What I want to talk about is the way that we've got, we're kind of addicted to a simplistic way of thinking about intelligence, right? And actually, many people have an allergy to thinking about it in a more complex way. And, you know, Howard Gardner and Kurt Fisher, who I studied with at Harvard, all they wanted to do was talk about it in a more complex way. And they had very little interest in anything like general intelligence and thought it was actually a concept that was dangerous, right? Howard Gardner once said to me, you know, that intelligence is the most political of all the psychological concepts, right? Because it becomes the meritocracy's kind of yardstick. And so, yeah, so that's a little bit of a preamble to like, okay, let's liberate thinking about intelligence from the IQ and start thinking about intelligence in a more complex way.
When you say that the concept has been very reified, obviously it has, right? Even though it started out without a really clear philosophical foundation. But let's take groups like Mensa, right? Let's take the way it's been used in military or any other kind of institution, not just for rooting out who is not qualified, but also who is qualified for higher level capacities. You would think that if it didn't map in some way to reality, the concept wouldn't have withstood this much time. So what is it measuring and how does that correlate to reality? And then also what is it not measuring? I would love to go in there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it is measuring something, you know, just like GDP is measuring something. So it's not that it's out of touch with reality. It's that it's revealing on reality in a way that's not revealing as much as it could. So it's drastically oversimplifying. It's kind of like taking a complex ecosystem and giving it a single number, when in fact there are many things happening in the ecosystem which could be given different numbers. And so in some institutional context, that's very valuable. And for when you're, for example, starting a huge army from scratch with a bunch of American farm boys, and you want to figure out like who could potentially be a general, like it's very useful in a gross way to sort that. And so this is important. But when you start thinking about, well, then what does it measure?
Yeah. Does it map to being a general? Well,
right. And that's where I'm saying, I'm not sure. This is a question. Then we have to go deeper and think, well, then what's the nature of the mind? Because if what does it measure means, well, what's there to measure, you know? And so that's where we need to tell a story about cognitive development and about the nature of the mind and how it grows and what the nature of learning is and what the nature of what we call intelligence actually is, busting the damn reality to get to the actual reality of intelligence. So my favorite phrase of Piaget is the idea that intelligence is the grasp of consciousness, right? Which is to say it's intelligence is consciousness operating in the world. Right. And so when we look at what intelligence is, what it has to do is it's these kind of skillful manipulation or operation, first on the physical, then on representations, then on abstractions, then on principles and axioms. Right. Which is to say that it's one thing to move physical objects around in a skillful way, which humans have done since who knows how long, millions of years. Right. But now we're moving around principles and axioms of science in a skillful way. So we're looking at a spectrum of cognitive complexity that grows over time. And, you know, the Piaget that was kind of chastised in your introduction to psychology course, that is not the actual Piaget. And Kurt Fischer, I think, is probably one of the most important psychologists of the 20th century, in part because he kept the Piagetian vision of this hierarchical cognitive architecture that emerges over time. So what we look at IQ is in many ways a generalized, if you want to go there, capacity for building skills up this hierarchy, right? Now, what we're missing with a typical way of kind of capturing some of those skills and saying those are valuable and those are intelligence is that there's a very wide array of skills, like a huge number of skills that you can build. And only some of those map with what we measure on IQ. So there are many people who are radically skilled at building really quickly skills up this hierarchy of skill. They're just not the kind of stuff that we measure and value on IQ tests. Right? So that's kind of one of the ways to slice this pie, is to say that
the multiple lines of intelligence model.
Precisely, multiple lines of intelligence. And so if there's anything like a generalized intelligence, it has to do with your basic capacity to build in any intelligence, right? And so some people are gifted at building in mathematical intelligences, which is to say they can move up and down this hierarchy of complexity and abstraction. They can do that in math really well. That's measured on IQ tests, right? Other people can move up and down this abstraction and complexity in, let's say, music or dance, right? And there are hierarchies of abstraction and dance. If you've seen a skilled dancer, what you have is someone who's supervening on a lot of possible moves and building this trajectory towards an aesthetic experience. It's a very abstract thing to do. very complex skill development, not going to get that in an IQ test. Also not valued in the Army, you know, in the places where IQ tests find the people who do the work right. And the predictive validity, I think, is sketchy, too. So I think one of the myths we need to bust is that these people who do great on IQ tests actually do great in the world. Like, this is, we need to look into that, just like the SAT and the GRE have very minimal predictive validity. Minimal. There are studies that show the GRE to be negatively predictive of graduate school success, which is to say you do good on the GRE, you actually do bad at writing a dissertation. It's interesting, right? Like, I did terrible on these kinds of tests. I'm dyslexic, so this is a little personal. I did pretty good at writing a dissertation. And so I think there's this complicated kind of cluster of things that make us look at particular types of skill development and particular capacities and particular lines. That's what we value. That's intelligence. We need to think more broadly. And in the kind of context we're in globally, I think it was Hunter S. Thompson who said, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro, right? And this is the situation we're in. And so we need to start looking at these much different forms of intelligence, but still thinking about growing them, right? And so it becomes less about one form of intelligence and more about many and the functional fit and the unique profile of the individual, right?
So do you think it's a worthwhile concept amongst the multiple lines of intelligence to separate ones that seem more generally abstract from more embodied? So, and this is just fitting a very rough intuition I think many people have. Say you take the mathematical line of development and you take linguistic, and then maybe you take some orientation towards the physical sciences, right? And you cluster those things. And you say computers could get fairly good at that without symbol grounding problem issues, right? Without sensorial grounding. But dance and maybe certain kinds of interpersonal and naturalistic and maybe even numinous or spiritual intelligences kind of cluster differently. Maybe we say they shouldn't. We shouldn't cluster them at all. They're eight totally different things. But is there a clustering like that that makes any sense? And then is there something that we can think of as general intelligence within the more cognitive domains that is accessible?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And this was one of the questions that drove the Neo-Piagetians, because the Neo-Piagetians got to the point where they said, okay, we know there are still these levels, but it's not like one big jump up. And yeah, it's many little jumps in many different areas, like a growing tree, many branches, like the Darwinian metaphor. But it's skill development. But they said, you know, that, like they said, intuitively there's clusters. You know, if you're good at physics and math, it doesn't mean you're going to be good at dance. You know? But if you're good at physics and math, you probably will be good at biology. So there's the kind of near and far transfer problem. And that led to the issue of possible basic structures underlying kind of the deeper branches in this trees of development. And so Robbie Case, who's another great Neo-Piagetian at the University of Toronto, close Fisher colleague, they did some of the first dynamic systems modeling of these things, and they found some of these deep structures. It's interesting, mathematical psychology. But what they showed, Robbie Case in particular, was that there was something like a deep structure to the mathematical domain, and it was the number line. And he had this incredibly simple study where he showed if you introduce inner city kids to the number line before any other mathematics, which, by the way, they don't get because they don't have like calendars hanging on the wall and their parents like aren't talking to them about linear things and they're not playing chutes and ladders like in a calm environment and stuff. But you show them this number line, they're doing as well in first grade as any of these kids from the suburbs, because they got the basic structure of the mathematical domain, which was, in a simplified manner, the number line. So there are other similar basic structures, let's say, with perspective taking that's social, right? So Robbie Case thought there was probably one for kind of mathematic spatiotemporal, and there was probably one for interpersonal. And I think there's also one for intrapersonal, which is to say your relation to yourself. So if I were to cluster the lines, I would cluster them around the classic big three, which would be the I, the we, and the it. And so I do think typically what we think of as intelligence is really facility with skill development in the domain of objective mathematical spatiotemporal realities, the kind of stuff that you push around in space and time. But there are other domains. There's a whole cluster of domains of the socioethical,
but when you were
which has to do
of abstraction for a minute. So
please.
The Rubik's Cube is moving around spatiotemporal physical things. But then as you move up into actual axioms, but axioms about, say, physics, right? So you're now into a degree of abstraction that requires not relating with just sensorial reality, but that requires mapping to sensorial reality in a different way than the intra or interpersonal domains would.
So precisely.
That maps all the way up in abstraction of that kind.
Exactly. So imagine the tree comes up, three branches go out. Each of those branches go all the way up to the axioms. And so the spatiotemporal logical mathematical one starts with the kid learning gravity and the ball bouncing and all of the things you do in the spatiotemporal world that Piaget investigated. He mostly investigated that line. He investigated the emergence of things like the idea of causality.
Right.
There's a time before kids understand causality.
Right.
And then they come to understand causality, cause and effect. And then you get hypothetico-deductive reasoning, which is still a higher, more abstract in that domain. But whole other things happen in that other branch of the moral and ethical, and similarly with the intra, but they're all related as well. And the branches intertangle at the higher levels. So this is the view. Again, the IQ test, what we think of is over there. Sorry.
If we look at the objective branch, right? Mathematics, sciences, et cetera. How well does IQ map to actual proclivity there? So say you have someone that solve Rubik's Cubes very quickly, will they actually be more likely to have novel developments in physics as a scientist? Or might they just be great at puzzles that are already defined, but not creative intelligence within that domain? I've heard some stories of like Niels Bohr being a very slow thinker, but having a slow process that led to profound originality. So let's talk about, even within the realm of reasoning about objective reality, different kinds of intelligence patterns.
Yeah, no, and this is one of the big questions in intelligence research. Even those who transcended the IQ concept, like Sternberg and Gardner, there was this question of, okay, IQ does seem to predict something in some areas. But what's interesting, Howard wrote a book called Creative Minds. And basically, this book is about this question. And it turns out that many scientists, like Einstein, for example, Einstein's reading Spinoza and playing violin, like in a little philosophical reading group as a patent clerk before relativity, you know what I mean? And then you look at other scientists who have far transfer away from the scientific domain, typically to some other area, which then gives inspiration back to the scientific domain. And this is, one of the things we're seeing at Lectica too, is that the broader your base, right, the healthier any of those branches become and the more easy the transfer is. So you do, in a sense, can predict in a simple way, this guy's going to be able to do those equations, right? And he's got this simple kind of horsepower in the cognitive kind of domain to do the equations, but is he going to be the innovative guy who comes up with totally new equations, right? Or realize that those equations aren't the equations we should be doing. So that's different than intelligence, right? So creative problem finding is different than even creative problem solving, let alone problem solving that's not creative. That's routine, which requires a lot of intelligence, right? Which is a whole class of problems that are very difficult, but routine. And then there are problems people don't even know yet. And so there's a space of unexplored kind of higher human potentials and forms of creativity that I think our schooling hasn't let us see what happens when you take someone with a super high mathematical IQ and teach them to meditate.
You just defined a number of important concepts, but before we lose them, there's some cross-training that you mentioned, which is important, but specifically you defined problem-solving and problem-finding as fundamentally different kinds of things. And it seems to me like problem-solving within an already existing problem domain kind of maps to hill climbing, right? And problem-finding maps to valley crossing from a kind of evolutionary biology perspective, which Eric Weinstein says the first one is what we call excellent. The second is remarkable. Remarkable figures out new shit. Excellent does a good job at predefined stuff. So Rubik's Cube is obviously problem solving, right? Figuring out new things that were in the unknown unknown requires a different kind of exploration. How do you assess each of those differentially?
And again, the assessment question is tough. I mean, that's the million-dollar question in a way, literally, because of the political economy of the testing industry. But if you can find a way to measure that creativity, if you can, and the valley crossing hill climbing metaphor is apt. I think that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. We're talking about those forms of creativity that break into new realms. And, you know, I think, what to say about assessing it? The honest answer is I don't know how to assess it. I think what we know how to assess is what we know how to assess, which is people, you know, working with the known.
And does IQ map more to hill climbing than valley crossing?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, I think the reason why that's not true sometimes is because, as I said, if you take someone who's got that and throw in an extra spice of something that they may not even be in their environment, because precisely they're the high IQ guy who gets kept away from those things, right? He's the high IQ guy who goes to just do math and blah, blah, blah. Send him to the Zendo. You know what I mean? Get him doing
training is under.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, so I think that's one of the lessons here is that, you know, the IQ test, can make it seem like that's it. When in fact, that's the kind of basic ingredients, as it were, in one of the areas, and you need to bring more to it. And that's just, I think, part of the picture. You know, skill development, the way Fisher thought about it, had a very intuitive way of thinking about growth, and not just static, unchangeable capacity, but growth and emergence of new capacity. And that's the way the mind works. I think that's the other fallacy of the IQ, and the way intelligence is often conceived is that it's either you're smart or you're not smart, right? When in fact, everything we know about the mind is that it's changing literally all the time, first of all. So you can be smart in the morning and not smart in the late evening, or vice versa. But it's also changing over the course of the lifespan drastically. And I already sketched that hierarchy from the sensory motor to the representational, to the abstract, to the principal, to the axiomatic. And that's a spectrum of hierarchical complexity that takes literally decades to unfold, and the right sociocultural conditions.
Okay, so I have a few questions to dive in. So when we think about hyperspecialization within a very specific line, and maybe even a specific subset of the line, versus some cross-training that leads to different kind of generalized capacities. So let's take a Bucky Fuller, polymath type, or like a Paul Erdős, almost savant, extreme specialist type, right? So you get somebody like Erdős in math who develops graph theory in a way that nobody else was even close, but he couldn't tie his shoes or really do anything else functionally. He had obviously allocated, like something had happened where all the horsepower was allocated in a way, but in a way that created real novel value, right? Then you see other people where they have novel value development across many fields that are obviously inter-informing each other because of lateral thinking and because of abstraction that is then finding generalized principles across domains. What's the difference in what's happening with those people, and how much of that is intrinsic versus developed versus reinforced?
I mean, it's so hard to tell. And I mean, the one lesson about the mind is, I think, uniqueness, unicity, which is to say that it's, you don't know, you know, it's the mind is a complex dynamical system. And so the butterfly can flap at one point in childhood, and you get a storm in Chicago late in adulthood, and you don't know, you can't connect those dots. And so it's interesting. You know, I think Kurt Fisher, again, I keep bringing him up. He's my beloved, advisor. He always tells the story of these two theoretical physicists. He knew both hit by cars crossing the street, right? Which is to say, again, you know, Einstein notoriously was, he wouldn't cash his paycheck. He'd use it as a slip in his book, as a bookmark. And then his secretary would find it and put it in his, you know, So there's this whole hypothesis, you know, that when you move up this hierarchy, representations, abstractions, principles, axioms, why would we need to do that on a savannah, like, let's say, a million years ago? Like, why is that a capacity of the brain? It's a strange thing. And so one thought is that as you move up that, you're kind of recycling some of your neuronal material, which is to say that every move in growth is also a loss. And every time you grow up, right, you also lose a little. So that's one of the reasons childhood is so kind of bittersweet, and you have these memories that are so interesting, because you know there was something you had as a child that you no longer have, that in some ways was as valuable, but it had to be lost as you grew. And that way of thinking about the mind is way more attractive to me than thinking about, well, you were a smart kid, now you're a smart adult, now you're, you know, just, I mean, that's one way to think about it. But you're also this very complex growing organism. The mind's like an organism that literally metabolizes its environment, And depending on what it metabolizes, it grows in certain ways or doesn't.
So what you're saying, I mean, it obviously makes sense that no matter how much muscular development we have, the moment we stop developing those muscles, they start to shrink because they require continuous input, that could be the same with cognitive or psychoemotional or other tasks. But there's also a zero-sum element to what you're saying in terms of total memory bandwidth and complexity of processing, where if we develop in some areas, it's almost like there has to be neuroplastic restructuring for optimization for those kinds of things at the cost of optimization for other things, which of course makes perfect sense. And I think is the way we usually think of it. There's a thought that's very interesting to me, which is a non-zero sum, right? A positive sum where one can develop new capacities while enforcing existing capacities and just have more net capacity, more computational capacity across the spectrum. Speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was often called explicitly thematized far transfer, right? And so what this is just a fancy way of saying, like, you know, you, let's say you're a really smart guy in mathematics and you start to learn the piano. Now you start to learn the piano and you've never played before, but you have a PhD in something, you're going to have to be like a little kid for many weeks, many months, maybe years at the piano. Now that can be very frustrating and you can separate it from everything else you know and try to build it as an independent skill. Or you can find a way to interweave this new skill development with your existing high-level skill. And Fisher would often talk about bringing a structure you know, transferring it over and down. And then you kind of get this helix model where you're bringing in everything that you're growing instead of growing things out in separate places. And you see this all the time. So it's like you'll have a meditation practice that you leave somewhere when you go to work, right? Or you go to the gym and then you come home and eat shit or whatever. And so I think there's this issue of the segmentation. And again, there's all these sociocultural reasons for that. So the explicitly thematized far transfer, or even near transfer, is what you're saying. It's about bringing a kind of coherence to the skill development so you don't have this fractured, weird profile of skills, but rather skills that are coherently related to one another. And this can be hard to pull off, you know, because we often have to hypertrophy skills in certain areas.
Right. It seems to me to be what is thematic of all of the polymaths that we study is that they didn't actually categorize or segment the different areas in which they had expertise as fundamentally different. They thought about universal reality as a much more integrated thing, and what they were studying in ecology became a model for how they thought about economics or psychology or biology, right? So they would then go to an abstraction level called complex systems, right, or complex causation or whatever, and then they would think about the lateral application of principles from one domain to other domains. So there was, of course, no just net memory because everything actually made sense and cross and interreferenced. But that's right. A learning modality thing.
Yeah, it's a learning modality thing. And schooling is a big deal here. Like, we wouldn't have IQ tests if we didn't have the factory schools. And we wouldn't think about the nature of the disciplines the way we do if we didn't have, you know, the kind of post-war military industrial university complex. I mean, it's very regimented. If you think about the training, for example, of the highly specialized engineers and doctors and these people. And so I'm very much a fan of blurring some of these distinctions. It doesn't mean lessening expertise, but it means, you know, bringing more to that and humanizing it. It's always been the call of the philosopher of education, is to bring the humanities into the science departments, if only so they do better science. You know, not so they don't do science, but so they can make the creative, like the Gaia hypothesis brings in, you know, ancient Greek myth. That's profound.
When you see like the Da Vinci machine doing surgery better than any surgeon, right? And that we're entering a domain in which almost every human skill that would require expertise is becoming automatable better than we do it, but the process to build the automation technologies requires not just hill climbing but valley crossing kinds of intelligence to figure out what those domains are and how to do them. How do you see the need for hyper specialization changing with advanced technology, exponential tech, and automation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people at the edges of those fields don't even really think about what the disciplinary boundaries are or ought to be. I think we're in uncharted territory in most of these fields, you know. And that's important to realize. You know, it's part of the broader global transformation, is a global transformation, the way knowledge is produced. And it means supervening on the traditional research academy and blurring those boundaries. They have to be, you know. systems biology. I mean, there's just, you name any field and it's two fields, any relevant field, it's two fields, you know, mind, brain, and education. This was Kurt Fischer founded the Mind, Brain, and Education Society. You know, I worked on that journal. This is a radically transdisciplinary field. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting period to be someone who has an expertise. So I have training in developmental psychology, but I'm working in all kinds of fields because the traditional kind of model of what the developmental psychologist does has changed so radically. And that's the story for a lot of people. So I think there's a need, and people feel it, where they're supplementing their graduate education with other quote unquote non-traditional forms of exposure, you know, which are kind of leavening that and bringing, yeah, like I said, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. and that's exactly what you're describing.
The weird turning pro as opposed to what was pro previously, right? So Now our best chess players can be beaten by AI, our best Go players can be, and that exponential curve hasn't even barely started to take off, right? So when it comes to hill climbing, we're going to build tools that out hill climb us. On every hill, right? In terms of excellence, what it used to mean, even in terms of machines that can outplay violin or whatever, right? So then does, and yet it is less clear as far as AGI goes, if we will get valley crossing in the same way, at least right now, right? So then the hypothesis that education should be more oriented towards problem finding than problem solving, and then figuring out how to utilize technology for problem solving. Would you say that's a big part of education?
I mean, you have to, this is one of the premises of my book that's coming out soon, is that artificial intelligence and things like basic income guarantees and radical changes in the kind of macroeconomic structure globally, they're going to make education, as we've known it, pretty irrelevant. And we're going to have to radically think, you know, rethink a lot of things. And so the thought about problem finding is actually a thought about values. Yeah. That's what's so interesting about that. And so, again, the basic issue in the philosophy of education is, what is a good life? What does it mean to be a good person or to have a good society? And so problem finding is along that trajectory of value. And that's, so again, we're back to the humanities and we're back to it.
I'm going to resist the temptation to get into ethics and existentialism and the temptation to get into forecasts about exponential tech and what that means for education and what the future of education should be. Flag, those are all podcasts I would like to do together. Coming back to people who are listening to this, you know, there might be some people who have children or planning on having children or are really interested in their development. Obviously, we kind of need to address that as its own thing. But for people who, like a lot of people are coming to NeuroHacker right now because they're interested in optimizing their own capacity, and their capacity roughly matches to their cognitive intelligence capacity. It also has to do with will and drive and creativity and a lot of other things. But so for people who are thinking about their own capacity and how they can think about it, how they can support it, how they can enhance it, you obviously said that the way of thinking about intelligence that is roughly valid in IQ is thinking about the capacity to develop skills more than any particular skill. Except, of course, the old shitty narrative was that's genetically fixed and then just kind of goes down with age as your brain declines. As opposed to every time you get a skill, that becomes now the knowledge there actually becomes a model for learning more stuff. So you can actually have an exponential rate of growth where all the skills and all the knowledge you develop become a basis for increased capacity for developing new things if you do lateral thinking and abstraction and generalization well, right? So a question that I have, because you mentioned a number of things. You said if you expose the kids from poor backgrounds to the number line that they just might not have been exposed to, they start to do better. If we're thinking about adults who already have, they already did their SATs, their IQ tests, they have some sense of kind of fixed capacity there, but they'd like to see if it's not fixed, if it is developable. What do we think about innate versus developable in terms of raw capacity? And where there is relevance or not to that story? And then what do we think about best processes for developing what we would roughly call the kind of any of the lines of intelligence? And I would say particularly the ones that relate to the it or objective categories.
Totally. Yeah, so the first question, that's again, is one of these questions that comes up with the IQ testing, right? Which is basically, oh, is it, you know, is it innate or can you change this thing? And I think the answer is yes, both. Right? There's clearly some genetic component. It's undeniable that if you take a broad swath of the population and give them an IQ test, it's going to accurately kind of represent something. And now many of those people will not change a lot in terms of taking.
Is there any good meta theory about what that is? I saw one study on genetics that looked at people with above 170 IQ whole genome assessments. And I think what it said was no individual SNPs made, it had high correlation, but there were patterns, combinatorial patterns across the whole genome, right? Probably that do something like, you know, increase gray matter density or something. Are there any kind of...
I don't know. I mean, I think, philosophically, the concept of heritability itself is complicated, right? So technically I didn't inherit my hands because heritability has to do with correlations and it's 100% correlation. So I'm not sure that we know enough about genetics yet to really speculate. And so it's hard to know if I inherited my dad's brain or if I inherited my dad's environment. But it's clear that, there are differences. And there are things that are harder to change and things that are more malleable. I think another reason we don't know the answer to this question is because basic levels, like Maslow level one, kind of like physical kind of nutrition and safe environments, and these things are not really available for many people on the planet. And so when you get these sweeping studies about IQ differences across, let's say, race or nationality or these things, it's like, can't really make inferences about anything innate or genetic here, because we're looking at, malnourished and so the nourishment of the brain isn't just nutrition. It's also the information and semiotic, right, environment.
And lack of trauma and fear. And
right. Totally. And so that's another reason I'm always so hesitant to say what's innate, because it's until we start to get really optimal basic conditions for people, it's really hard to say. What was in their genes and what became epigenetic from the womb. So I think we're looking at kind of nature via nurture, as opposed to nature versus nurture. And when it comes to changing intelligence and growing intelligence, there's so much, exercise and nutrition, number one. focus. A lot of what an IQ test gets at is just your ability to sit still and focus. Like with the first kind of 17 army alphas, what they were really getting at was, can this farm boy sit at a desk and take this test for 20 minutes? That was really the main, to my mind, what they really captured. So things that allow you to focus and give attention are very important. So meditation is classic, but even just the concerted effort to control your own informational environment. Focus on one thing at a time, which our culture is hard to do. So, and I put that under nutrition, because that's like, as I said, your mind is metabolic with the environment. And so I'm very careful with what I eat, even if it's in quote information.
The psychic toxins that you want not to be eating as far as intelligence is concerned?
That's interesting. Yeah. I think of them as kind of invasive species in the ecology of the mind, I think advertisement is a great one. One of the reasons that we are driven to distraction is because of the culture of advertisement that we have. And then in general, things that shorten the attention span by design, right? Not things that shorten the attention span because they're naturally short, like a bird flies by, right? Okay. But there are things that shorten our attention span by design. And so we need to avoid those things because they teach us that that's how information works and that's how learning is.
So if someone goes to a website where they take an article and break it up into 20 next buttons to maximize.
Exactly, dude.
Suggest avoiding those websites for the attention she has in mind.
Yeah, it's not so much what is it. Maybe it's a good article, maybe it's not. But literally the action of doing that is different from sitting with a book for 45 minutes, let's say. And so I'm saying, not it'll engage fully with the culture, but be mindful that you can have junk food for your mind.
Yeah.
You know, just like you can have junk food for your body. And the and that's the stuff that the culture wants us to eat, right? And so you have to find the secret hidden good stuff in the back where it's a long article with no advertisements. You know, you're like, whoa, like it's actually good for you.
Independent of what you're studying, just focusing for a period of time, focused in the muscle of focus, whether it's changing neural structures and the connectomics of it or whatever it is, right? There is some kind of development of the capacity for focus, probably intensity of focus and duration of focus, right? Yeah. So that's important. But then you could be focused on very different topics. And you might say that some topics, obviously, whether the information is accurate or not, and if it's factual information, kind of matters. But are there certain topics that you think have more relevance or ways of studying them or ways of thinking about them?
Well, and this is where it gets interesting, because the very next thing I was about to say is that you also need to learn about learning. Which is to say, one of the most important things you can focus on is the nature of development itself and the nature of your own learning. So learn about the nature of learning scientifically, but also learn about your own unique learning needs and patterns, right? So not everyone can sit with a book for 45 minutes, but they can do 15 minutes, get up, stare into space, walk around, 15 minutes, get up, stare into space, walk around, right? So you need to learn how you work. And a lot of research can help with that. Things like the neurohacker resources, all of these things should be grist for that mill. But one of the things that you see with people who go post-conventional and kind of become self-actualizers and move up to these higher levels is that they're very reflective about their own learning. They know how they learn, when they learn best. They know what excites them. They know how to follow investigative patterns independently. And so they're reflective. And so they create these virtuous cycles of learning for themselves naturally throughout life, as opposed to being kind of extrinsically motivated and driven, which is what the schools, you know, often will do.
So this is a quantified self process around mind.
One way to do it is to quantify it totally. And that can help. You know, you can also mistake the numbers for reality with the quantified self too. So again, it's not, numbers are great if they're measuring something that's there. And that's one of my concerns with the quantified self is like, do you know the measurement errors on your tools? Like, how often does it mismeasure your heartbeat? How often does it not capture what it says to be capturing? I mean, the blood sugar monitors, for example, are a metrological mess, right? And it's dangerous. Similarly with
quantified self devices right now, and because we want to curate the tools that can help people. Exactly. So far, the sensitivity and specificity is not good enough for us to feel that the biofeedback optimization is actually optimizing rather than suboptimizing. Most of the consumer devices. Of course, there are medical grade devices that are very good, but we're not seeing good enough correlation on many of them yet.
It's interesting. And that's what measurement does. And I think a lot about measurement in general. And one of the things it does is it we can trick ourselves. And it's worse than not knowing what's going on.
Sure.
It's because you actually think you know what's going on and you don't. And that's why demi-realities can be weird. And so I love the quantified self insofar as it's reflective and it creates that virtuous cycle. But if you're creating a cycle on feedback that's not accurate, then you can get off course.
But someone could have a qualified self feedback that is also wrong. Where
something
feels good, but that is actually a kind of addictive feel good rather than a virtuous cycle, and they optimize. So this is why you need layers of self-reflection.
Yeah, well, and the same cycle that drives learning drives addiction, right? It's the kind of, this is Theo Dawson's refrain and how learning works. You need to actually kind of co-opt the kind of, you know, opioid cycle into the dopamine opioid cycle into these learning, these virtuous cycles, as opposed to into other things like, for example, video game or research and design. They figured out how to capture really well. And it's about that zone of proximal development, or the quote Goldilocks zone, which is that zone that's not too hard, but not too easy. And so if you know about your own learning, you can put yourself in that situation all the time where you are not in over your head and challenged to the point of giving up, but not, it's so easy that you're bored. And so you're not learning. And so that, again, just an example of what being reflective about your own learning will give you, the ability to stay in that zone of proximal development with most of, if not all of your tasks.
So I'm curious to hear your thought on something. There are a few kind of neurohacking methods that have some early indicators that they elevate IQ using that shitty old metric, for whatever it's worth. So there was a neurofeedback study that showed multiple point increase in a week of a particular form of medical neurofeedback that was statistically significant. In adults where that supposedly doesn't change. There's a technology, the website called ZingUp, and it's basically sensory motor coordination activities that supposedly drive neurogenesis. MRI showed increased hippocampal volume because you're actually increasing development of progenitor neurons. And it also showed elevation of IQ amongst other meaningful scores. It makes sense, right? There's a plausibility that neurofeedback, if you're actually taking signal from the brain, feeding it back to the brain, so the brain gets a whole new sensory bandwidth that it didn't have to refine its own process. So you get increased signal to noise of process within the organ of computation itself, at least one of the organs of computation, that could increase its efficiency of process independent of information, content information input, right? Just process information input. It makes sense that if you're increasing neurogenesis and you're getting actual gray matter density increases, you could increase the computational bandwidth of the system. What do you think of these kinds of things? And are there things that you know of that you think are meaningful intelligence developing capacities that are kind of physiologically oriented?
That's a great. So I love biofeedback. I think many forms of, let's say, mental distress, extreme states of consciousness, the things that people seek psychopharmacology for, typically from a psychiatrist. These are issues with the brain, often physiological issues. Now, that means we need to treat them somehow by working on the brain. I don't think that means we need to intervene necessarily in some drastic chemical way. I think there are ways to do it that are, like you're saying, brain entrainment, that are not, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy, but much more like letting the brain kind of perceive itself, as it were, and work in that way. I think the way you describe how it probably works is probably correct. Now, we have to remember, of course, that we're moving IQ tests. We're not necessarily moving IQ. And so I think we need to have the qualia on the inside of that quanta, which is to say, what does it feel like after going through those types of biofeedback techniques? Do you feel more capacitated, more lucid and insightful, for example? And that's, I think, the proof is in that pudding, and also with things like predictive validity. But I think these are the most promising for me, are these forms of biofeedback. I think the brain and the body shouldn't be separated at all. And I think one of the limits to contemporary neuroscience is that separation. So, the forms of somatic practice that get people to inhabit their bodies more, I think, have a lot of potential. Things like, the spatial dynamics and yoga and Tai Chi, which bring the brain back into the body and not out of it into some tube that just feedback. And, so I think one of the issues we have, and one of the reasons we're seeing kind of an epidemic of, I think, cognitive underperformance, let's put it that way, in a really nice way, is the fact that people's bodies themselves are hurting before it ever becomes kind of a neurological thing. So that would be some general advice is health.
So let's go mechanistic for a minute, right? If someone's body is actually hurting, right, they have physical pain because of their bad computer ergonomics, posture, or whatever it is, then we know that pain is mediated via chemistry and nerve signals. So you're going to be having continuous noise input into the nervous system. You're going to have inflammatory chemicals, inflammatory cytokines that can cross the blood-brain barrier, cause neuroinflammation, and affect all aspects of top-down neurologic function, including cognitive. So getting out of pain is a way to actually take a load off the nervous system, increasing its capacity and bandwidth to deal with other stuff. So that's
a much clearer way of saying what I was trying to say. That's exactly what I meant by saying that. Please.
But we can think of a lot of mechanisms, right? So there are there's a lot of studies going on regarding epigenetics, genetic expression from various forms of exercise, and aerobics versus anaerobics versus high-intensity interval training actually affect different gene expressions. And there's something like 7,000 genes that we've identified actually have epigenetic modulation with different forms of exercise. So that means that whatever we thought was maybe genetically attributable as innate is also not fixedly innate, right? It's changeable. And it might, so your yoga might be affecting some of those things through the breath, through the parasympathetic processes that are happening from the slow movement and the proprioception, right? From the kind of vagal stimulation that might happen. We might also see, though, that there's certain kinds of benefits that high intensity interval training does to increasing, right, like the good stress on the system that leads to upregulation of homeostatic capacity that yoga doesn't.
Yeah. Right.
So you've, but like, I'm going to make a distinction between things that increase capacity where the capacity was already decreased from baseline because of pathology, right? Pain is pathology. Versus someone is already in pretty good health. There's no obvious pathology. And now we're wanting to increase baseline.
Right.
So I'm curious, as you forecast into the future and you think about some of the developmental possibilities, there's obviously like pretty wild future tech scenarios that are actually getting not that far out, right? Like brain chip implants are becoming something that is a lot of companies are investing pretty heavily in, where you would just augment your processing capacity with the processing capacity of the entire cloud running on quantum computers. Outside of that, right? Let's assume that we don't get that ever or anytime soon, and we're looking at increasing endogenous processing capacity of this system. What do you foresee if things go well in terms of us being able to have decreased stress, better medical systems, better schooling, education, psychological development? What do you see in terms of the not too distant future human intelligence as what would the general capacity look like, and what might some of the modalities that we start engaging more in look like?
Right, right. That's it. I mean, yeah. So the kind of concrete utopian vision of the future of intelligence, you know, would be one where the broad baseline is raised in a huge way, right? So if we have a basic income guarantee and kind of an integral social safety net and some of these other social miracles that I've written about, we would look at something like a broad kind of raising of the floor of what, you know, kind of quote, general intelligence, just because so much is a result of that. You know, but I think for the individuals looking at the cutting edge, you know, I think it's about horizontal and vertical growth in a simplistic way. That's kind of stereotype, but we don't know the range of people's multiple intelligences, which is to say the first step for many people is just to explore lines that they have not explored, right? So it's not to keep going up. We can talk about that. It's about going wider, right? And it's, we already discussed this briefly, but that I think is something that people will have the freedom to do in a way they've never had before if some of these other things get sorted out, right?
Wider than intentionally cross-applying.
Yeah, the intentional crossing of line in a space not of scarcity where you're frantically trying to keep your job and how could I possibly take up yoga, right? But in a space of educational abundance where your unique skill, the unique skill profile that you have as a potential could actually be expressed. I think what we're looking at now are kind of truncated skill profiles where a lot of potentials are not expressed for a variety of reasons. So I think the first issue is to kind of fill that out, which is to say to fill out the rest of your kind of profile of what you're kind of capable of doing. And that may mean, you know, work in hospice care, or it may mean working soup kitchen, or maybe playing soccer, right? I mean, who knows? But the point being that, you know, we're limited in the ways we can grow often by this sense of educational scarcity that surrounds us and the limits of time. So, you know, well, no problem. Go for it. Expand horizontally. I think another thing, again, this is about the unexplored kind of educational frontier, right? Another place where we haven't explored is states, right? So do a lot of learning and skill development, but state experiences, which is to say meditative states, right? And other forms of flow, which is another state that's very popular these days to speak about. You know, these the exploration of state experiences and the way these interface with capacity development, I think, is another place for people to, if they're topped out at a certain capacity, let's say, start to bring in a state practice, which brings that capacity to operate under a different state and then you'll find new potential emergence, right? And so it's another thing that our schooling and society doesn't give us explicitly, but that we're seeking on the side all the time. I mean, sometimes explicitly with meditation, but rock concerts, movies, all of these things are subtle state-inducing, causal state-inducing. So I think there's a way that when we're not as concerned with manipulating and kind of, you know, competing, and when there's a sense of, as I say, educational abundance, then the value of those state experiences, aesthetic experiences, you know, the rapture of a sunset is a state experience. Like the value and the intrinsic value of those things will become clearer and clearer and clearer. And it's hard. You have to go searching for those now. And I think that
important. I just want to reiterate in slightly different words, which is that much of how we've been developing ourselves is like monoculturing our mind, right? Like we're trying to produce this thing. So we are just growing hybridized GM wheat fields in our mind and not developing a robust, complex ecosystem that can actually resist foreign species when they come in and has resilience across a lot of different capacities. So one of the things that you're wanting is that people don't keep trying to just optimize the total amount of wheat yield of their mind, but they're actually seeking to optimize a lot more complex set of things where you wouldn't even really call it optimizing. You would call it exploring.
Yeah. And that's, I think, good for a few reasons. You know, one is that the world we're moving into is not a world where monocultures are going to survive on multiple levels. And that analogy is so apt because the monoculture of agriculture came around the same time that we got these mass, you know, kind of post-war high schools. And so you're looking at literally the generation of a kind of monoculture of the mind. So that's deep. And so, yeah, so it's about breaking out of that monoculture into this much more kind of symbiotic way of thinking about where is my niche and how that niche going to change as the culture around me changes as I grow and grow more. And so it's very much a moving away from the static kind of almost arithmetical, like in the sense of arithmetic way of thinking about the mind, into a dynamical way of thinking about the mind. So that's a good insight. And so it's about exploration, but it's exploration in the hope of finding, which is to say that you search and then you find, and then all of a sudden something grows that never would have grown, which may be exactly what's needed. And that's, I think, the fear of the monoculture is that it's not resilient. There's all these reasons that it's literally dangerous. So if you can only do one thing, if you can only give one food to the world, and or only eat one kind of food from the world, then you're very in a precarious situation. So we need to all become very, you know, very broad. And I think the Renaissance man's like necessary for everybody.
So I agree with this. And there's an interesting question I want to bring up. I have two friends where I've had this conversation in the last few weeks who have something like 6 standard deviations more computational processing power than most people, off of normal assessment curves. They also have other underdeveloped capacities as a result of how they've developed that. And they both expressed fear in doing things that would develop those other capacities because of not wanting to lose the unique capacities that they've developed, where there's a question of like, have I allocated all of my neural process in some zero sum, or even if it's positive sum, fixed, you know, positive sum kind of way, where I am now a very useful tool. And if I were to reallocate it, it might make me feel better, but I would actually be a less useful tool. How founded do you think that kind of concern in those outlier cases is?
These are deep questions in the philosophy of education, which is about what's a good person, what's a good society. And I think you don't want to put a square peg in a round hole. So there's a uniqueness factor, and there's a kind of where does the puzzle piece fit factor. But there's something true also about that fear. This is kind of a far transfer, as it were, but I remember David Lynch, right, the great film director, he went to do psychotherapy and he was like, you know, if I do this, you know, will my art suffer? And the therapist was like, maybe, you know, and he was like, nope, not doing it. And so he was willing to like live with the wound, to do the art. And so I think some people may be willing to live with a kind of truncated whole set of skills and a kind of withered limb, as it were, in order to have this super strong branch over here holding up something that needs to be held up. So I think we don't want to homogenize, you know, but the question is then about what does it feel like to be them? And there are other things that if they could change them and not lose that, they would. And so I'd have a conversation. I wouldn't, but that's a deep question. And I think we're looking at a society of increasing neurodiversity and increasing kind of unique individual niche fitting. And so we need to be careful and judicious about trying to fit square pegs into round holes and trying to maybe perhaps make new shapes, you know, fit the shape more to this unique neural profile than to what the machine needs. And again, the machine is that arithmetic mentality, the machine, whereas the dynamical mentality is one where there's a kind of coactive system between both. This is, again, the educational futures.
For those who don't have the language, machine is a complicated system, right? Ecosystem is a complex system. Ecosystem is changing. It doesn't have a fixed blueprint, cannot predict its future states from the current state perfectly, and it's self-organizing in response to its environment. Complicated system might have a lot that goes into the circuit design, to the blueprinting of it. But once it does, it's fixed. It is not self-repairing, not self-organizing, and not adaptive. Humans understand complicated systems. We build them all, right? We understand them much better than complex systems. We're just starting to understand complex systems. So you're thinking about the mind as a complex system, which is, of course, makes sense because the brain is a complex system. The physiology is a complex system. Ecosystem is, right? Culture that's informing the mind is a complex system. And that one of the things that it sounds like you're saying is that we've been using complicated system metaphors. How do we make it a better machine, a better computer, a better robot, a better, you know, Turing machine, whatever, right? For something that is actually a complex dynamic, which needs supported in fundamentally different ways. And you optimize complicated systems, you support the emergence of complex systems. Mm-hmm. So rather than thinking about reductionist metric optimization of a complicated mind, we think about what supports the flourishing of self-development and autopoiesis of a complex mind.
Right. Beautiful. Yeah. And that's, again, that's both the kind of brilliance of the IQ and the tragedy of it, is that it simplified this incredibly complex thing to a single number, which had some, you know, it was useful. It was also dangerous. But yeah, the mind is not like that. It's not complicated. It's radically complex. I mean, it's literally the most complex thing in the universe, aside from the universe itself, right? This is the brain. And so the inside of the brain is that now. Again, start to do some state practices and you'll see that there's some of that. So it's just very interesting to think about what that future of the brain and education is.
You said one thing that was so important, which was, complicated versus complex. That's one big distinction. But one of the other distinctions was intrinsic versus extrinsic value.
Yeah.
Thing. Most of the time when we think about developing our intelligence, we're thinking about how we can be a better tool. Either so that we can crush the competition or make more money or raise in some corporate ladder, like be better at some task that we can be externally better. Right. And that might be just because of wounded childhood ego that didn't feel enough, and then being smart was our compensation strategy, so we get to be enough. And, you know, like, it. And you're asking this question of, while developing our extrinsically recognizable and valuable qualities, what is the intrinsic quality of experience of how we are developing and just experiencing life moment to moment and valuing that? And obviously for an educational system, valuing the child's intrinsic experience as well as developing their capacities for extrinsic utility, but not mostly just seeing them as utilities for the future of economy or military or whatever. But then also for all of us as adults, really paying more attention to the balance. Yeah. Those two.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think we're, you know, extrinsic motivation is part of what it means to be alive. You know, I mean, there's always going to be extrinsic motivations, but if that's all you have, it can become very difficult. And it's a classic principle in, you know, psychotherapy. You can't, if you're totally dependent upon the world, you're very vulnerable. I mean, it's a very precarious situation. And it feels that way when you're trapped in a situation of tied to extrinsic value. So freeing your goals from that, transcending but including extrinsic value, right? Which is to say you get that and then you move beyond it and you include the kind of getting the extrinsic skill, you include that within this broader project that's intrinsic. And similar to that transfer thing we discussed before, bringing it all together into a kind of coherence of development of self. So an intrinsic part, you know, that's part of it. You know, again, as I said, the people who become post-conventional, you find them to be self-directed learners and intrinsically motivated. And even those who are, a great example of this is dyslexia, right? I'm dyslexic. It's actually true that dyslexic, you know, who succeed, the reason they succeed is not because of the special training they receive. Typically, it's because they attach an intrinsic motivation to something like reading. And so you find all these stories of, you know, high achieving dyslexics, and at some point in their childhood, they found something they were just passionate about. And so all the pain of school and all of the, that didn't matter anymore because they were intrinsically motivated. And oh, and by the way, along the way, they got these extrinsic things handled, but they're doing them for their own reasons. And so there's something I think many of the people who are the Valley Crossers end up being mavericks and outsiders in traditional schooling precisely for this reason, because they're doing it for their own purposes. They're intrinsically motivated and the school demands certain extrinsic things. So that kind of separation of learning from schooling often follows from the separation of intrinsic from extrinsic. And that's the advice I give to most of my friends who have kids, and like, separate learning from schooling. Learning is awesome. Schooling sometimes can be, sometimes not so much. But if you confuse those and think learning is what takes place in school, you know, then you'll never learn for the rest of your life. And so that intrinsic motivation is huge. And but that gets really deep really quickly. That's the problem with intrinsic motivation, is that you go directly from, you know, simple questions about what am I learning to deep questions about what's the significance of my life? What do I really want to be? What kind of person am I already? What can I transform? Like, these are the deeper questions. Which,
to the degree that we are wanting to raise children to fill roles in a predefined society, we of course don't want them to ask.
Right. But they have to ask now, I think.
Exactly. Okay. This has been a blast. As we're wrapping up, if people are interested in understanding their capacities as a baseline to both see what is most relevant for them to develop and then to see if the developmental things they're doing are working, other than IQ, what might you recommend to people as ways they can assess their intelligence, their multiple lines of intelligence, their ecological complexity of thought? Like, what is Lectica a useful tool? What are some other ones for assessment?
Yeah, Lectica. So you can go to lectica.org. And I'm sure there'll be links on the NeuroHacker website that we can put there. And there's a few assessment options at Lectica, which they get at that spectrum from abstraction and complexity in particular lines. And these can be useful for self-diagnostic purposes. There's a whole bunch of uses for lectical assessments. So I think those are important. Addition, again, it's about the standardization and the psychometrics of it are valuable. There's an array of assessments out there which you could use in a quantified self type way. And so I would never discourage people from exploring those. But I think, you know, keep in mind all these lessons about measurement and measurement of the mind in particular. And just take them with a grain of salt, you know, and know that, you know, flying blind, which is to say without measures, is better than flying with measures you trust that are wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's just a statement. That's just true. And so play with them, but really be careful about the ones you hang your hat on. And, you know, journaling is actually an extremely important developmental catalyst. So, which is to say, witness it all, note it all, see what's working, see what's not working, pay attention to yourself. And sometimes journaling really can help with that in a fundamental way. And you can do it in a structured way. And there's, you know, whole approaches to doing that, but I found it to be valuable for people that I know and for myself. So that's just another way of assessment. You know, you talked about the kind of quanta and the qualia, right? And so that's the qualitative assessment of self. And you can keep a running log in your own head, but writing it down helps, gets it out.
Have you seen any correlation of things like different forms of imaging. So say MRIs that are looking at neural density, QEEGs, and different forms of psychometric or intelligence scores that you think are either already valuable or promising of a new kind of mind-brain interface science.
I mean, this isn't really my field. I haven't. I mean, I've been really intrigued by the meditation research that's coming out of Madison, Wisconsin. I think that's where it is. And that's the, it's interesting because it's an ancient technology of self-development. And it's showing profound neurological, as you'd expect, but it's just shocking to see really how stark some of these findings are. So that's intriguing to me. But yeah, that's about as much as I can say, you know, and so I'm kind of old school methods. I think it's part of my, part of it comes from my caution around the assessment, you know, which is to say, you know, the DSM is a nightmare. The IQ tests are a nightmare. Like don't articulate your self-understanding in these languages handed to you. You know, find new ways to think about the self, and things like Lactico can help like that. But
things like, you know, reductionist metrics and wrong metrics are a concern for you, but metrics, objective metrics about subjectivity, are their own category of nightmare.
Right. Yeah. And then you get the metrics that work, and then those are scary for a different reason.
Right.
Because they actually work. So anyway, there's too many. We can just jump down another rabbit hole, Daniel, but we need to go.
No, this is good. Zach, this was a blast. Thank you. Yeah. This was a really fun first podcast for us to do, and a fun topic. And I imagine people might have a lot of follow-up questions regarding assessment and development and et cetera. And we might get to follow up on those. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I welcome that. It's a blast.
All right.
Beautiful. That was fun, man.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Collective Insights. For the full show notes on this episode and for more great interviews, visit us at neurohacker.com/collective-insights. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.